Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, Everyday Heroes, we look at the lesser-known people who have shaped history. Then we revisit the American Revolution through the story of the Loyalists, those who fought on the side of Great Britain. Finally, what does the retirement of Supreme Court Justice Anthony Kennedy mean for the United States? We know the role of presidents and other leaders in shaping history, but we hear little about the unsung heroes, many who have risked their lives to liberate and rescue others. Who might some of those secret heroes be? We're joined by Paul Martin, journalist, editor, and author of Secret Heroes, Everyday Americans Who Shaped Our World. Welcome, Paul Martin. Often thousands are forgotten for the good they've done in making societies better, and you pulled a few out and wrote about them in your book.
That's right. I've always had a lifelong fascination with unsung heroes. I've kept a file for years on these characters when I come across them in my reading or see something on television. When I decided to do a book, I tried to pull out 30 of the most interesting, offering a really broad range of time periods and backgrounds, occupations, and so forth. And the mix that I have is just filled with people that ought to be better known. I mean, there's Hercules Mulligan, who is a tailor in New York City during the Revolutionary War, and he was recruited as a spy. And on two occasions, since he had British officers as customers, he learned about plots to waylay General Washington and was able to warn him and very possibly save his life.
Wasn't his brother also involved?
Was also involved. In fact, his brother was a conduit for another outstanding thing that Mulligan did, and that is he literally converted Alexander Hamilton to the American cause. Hamilton was born in the Caribbean, and he had grown up. He was a loyal British subject, and when he came to study in New York, he went to King's College, which is today's Columbia University, and he needed a place to stay, and he contacted Hercules Mulligan's brother, who referred him on to Hercules, and Alexander Hamilton stayed with Mulligan, and through the course of evening's conversations with Mulligan and his friends, Hamilton was won over to the American cause and became, you know, a real leader.
One of the characters that I thought was most interesting and that I hadn't known as much about as I would have liked to was Mary Elizabeth Bowser, who played a huge role in the Civil War. Tell us about her and her impact on the Civil War.
She was born a slave in Richmond, Virginia. Her master was a hardware merchant in Richmond, and he actually sold off Bowser's family, her mother and father and brother and sister. His name was John Van Loo, and when he died, his daughter, Elizabeth Van Loo, bought back Bowser's family and gave them all their freedom. And Elizabeth Van Loo sent Mary Bowser to Philadelphia to be educated. Bowser came back to Richmond just as the Civil War was starting, and when the Civil War began, Elizabeth Van Loo formed a spy ring for the Union. She recruited Mary Bowser because she was a rarity. She was a former slave, an African-American who was educated, could read and write, which was obviously a rarity at that time. And Van Loo was able to place her in the White House of the Confederacy, the home of Jefferson Davis and his wife and children. Bowser was a family servant, and she took care of Jefferson Davis's children and served meals, cleaned up afterwards. Well, as far as Davis knew, she was an illiterate slave, and he and his officers spoke openly in front of her. She also had a photographic memory, and Davis would leave his papers strewn around on his desk, and she could just, at a glance, pick up all sorts of information about Southern troop movements and finances and so forth. She relayed those on to the Union. She was recognized in 1995 as one of the most important spies for the Union cause during the Civil War.
How was she able to convey that information?
There were some fascinating ways. They would hide messages in like a basket full of eggs. They would hollow out one of the eggs and put messages inside the egg. And another way was they would put it in the shoes of a slave, and the Southerners were disdainful and wouldn't, you know, want to have anything to do with the slaves and their clothing, and so they were able to get things past the Southern soldiers. So it was an amazing display of bravery for 2 years to be by herself, right, as I said, in the lion's den. It turned out that she discovered so many secrets that they began to suspect that there was a mole somewhere in the White House of the Confederacy, and so she fled. She was there for 2 years, and her last act was she tried to burn down the White House of the Confederacy. She wasn't successful, but she fled in 1864 and was never heard of again. She disappeared from history.
There were three other women that I thought were particularly interesting in your book. Anne Royal was one, Grace Abbott, and Inez Boisevain.
Yes. All three of those I'd never heard of, and in fact, I could say I think all but one or two of the characters in my book I'd never heard of, and I wasn't familiar with even the ones that I had heard of. For instance, Hedy Lamarr, I didn't know that the achievements she did that were totally unknown to the public. But the three persons that you mentioned, Anne Royal was just this fabulous character. She was born on the frontier and survived Indian attacks, and she ended up marrying an older man who was quite wealthy. And when he died, she traveled around a bit, and she was well-to-do. But then her husband's family overturned the will, and she was left absolutely penniless at the age of 54. So she decided she'd become a writer, and she started writing travel books, and she wrote one novel. She lived hand-to-mouth the whole time. And then she went to Washington, D.C., and when she was in her 60s, she began a newspaper. And she was a terror. She was the first muckraker in American journalism. And she would traipse around the halls of Congress and government offices and just buttonhole officials and grill them. She would print everything, you know, she found. And she had very strong opinions. She was adamantly for the separation of church and state, and she was just a holy terror.
I think you mentioned that people still study her in journalism schools.
They do. She's regarded as the first of the muckrakers. She's really the first investigative journalist in early history of journalism. Journalism often was advertising or PR almost, and she really dug for the truth and was fearless. And she made so many enemies that the U.S. Post Office stopped delivering her newspaper because she made so many enemies on Capitol Hill. So she started a second newspaper and delivered it on her own. And of course, she never had a very wide circulation or never made any money. In fact, she died, I think she had a total of 6 cents when she died, but her influence was tremendous.
And then the other two really interesting women, Grace Abbott and Inez Boisevain, had to have a little bit more of a similar impact.
Grace Abbott is just someone that you never hear of, and the woman was absolutely amazing. She grew up in Nebraska and was trained as a teacher, and she went to Chicago and studied at the University of Chicago, and then she became involved in protecting immigrants. And for 9 years, she ran the Immigrant Protective League. And then she was recruited to the U.S. Children's Bureau, which at that time was a federal office to overlook the rights of the interests of children. And she improved the lives of millions of people through information she distributed on maternal health care and infant health care. Even then, and still today, the infant mortality rate in this country is really shocking. We have 4 times the infant mortality rate of Japan today. And she did so much to protect the children. The other thing she did was she was instrumental in writing the child labor provisions of the Social Security Act. And she also wrote child labor provisions in the Fair Labor Standards Act, which was passed in 1938. Unbelievably, there was still exploitative child labor up to 1938. But afterwards, when that law was passed, we finally ended that shameful period of our history. The other person you mentioned, Inez Boisevain, she was a colorful character. She was one of the few characters in the book who grew up in a wealthy family. And she had a privileged upbringing. She went to Vassar College, but she was a real rebel, and she was in the forefront of the women's suffrage movement, and she made speeches on campus, and as I said in the book, I think the people at Vassar probably threw themselves a party when she finally graduated. But she went on to New York, and she got a law degree at New York University, and one of the first things she did was investigate the horrible prison conditions at Sing Sing, and she wrote a report, and it resulted in widespread reforms. And she literally gave her life for the cause. She was speaking in the western half of the United States, trying to get passage of universal women's suffrage, and she collapsed on stage in Los Angeles, and it turned out she had pernicious anemia, which today is very treatable, but back then it wasn't, and she ended up dying, and so she was a martyr to her cause.
And only 30 years old.
Exactly. And they told her if she cut back and, you know, stopped exerting herself, she could probably weather this health issue, but she refused to. She literally gave her life for the cause.
And then if we were to move up in time, there are two other people. They're very different. One was Golden Rule Jones, who was very interesting, and the other was Kirk Bloodsworth.
Golden Rule Jones, of course, was a progressive leader during the progressive era at the turn of the 20th century. He grew up poor, and he got into the oil business, and he started his own company and made a fortune. He moved to Ohio and started Ohio Oil, which was bought out by Standard Oil, and so he became quite wealthy. But he had a tragedy in his life. His wife and one of his children passed away. He remarried, and his second wife lived in Toledo. So he moved to Toledo, and he started a company to produce oil drilling equipment. It had the memorable name of the Acme Sucker Rod Company. And he was 50 years ahead of his time. He instituted an 8-hour workday. He refused to use child labor. I mean, this was all before, while these things were going on, he was doing these things on his own. He gave Christmas bonuses, paid vacations. He built a park and playground for his employees. And his whole point of view was that everyone should live by the Golden Rule. I mean, it was very simple, and that's the way he treated his employees, and they responded with incredible loyalty. Well, he became famous for this, and they started around Toledo, started calling him Golden Rule Jones, and then he was put up for election by the Republicans and for mayor of Toledo, and he won. And the amazing thing was that when he started introducing the same kinds of reforms that he'd done in his company to city government, the Republicans were up in arms. Business interests, they thought, you know, that this was not the way to go. So the next election for mayor, they kicked him to the side, and he ran as an independent, and he won with 70% of the vote, and he was reelected three other times. He died in office when he was 54, but he was a real progressive, and he was one of the people who brought us things that we accept today. Everyone thinks that a 40-hour work week and paid vacations are the right of all Americans, but if it wasn't for people like Samuel Jones, that just wouldn't have happened. The other person you mentioned, Kirk Bloodsworth, he's interesting for several reasons. One, he's the only living character of the 30 people I write about. He's still alive. He grew up on the eastern shore of Maryland. His family was, they were watermen. He grew up crabbing and oystering, helping his dad on his boat. And he joined the Marines, and after the Marines, he married a woman who lived in Essex, Maryland, which is a suburb of Baltimore. And at the very time that he settled in Essex, a 9-year-old girl was brutally raped and murdered, and Kirk Bloodsworth was arrested for this. He had nothing to do with it. He was completely innocent. And he was convicted basically on the testimony of a 7-year-old and a 10-year-old who said they saw him. Well, he spent 9 years in prison. He was convicted and given the death sentence, and he was sent to prison in Baltimore, the state prison penitentiary. His death sentence was overturned. He was given 2 life terms. And to while away the time, I mean, to keep himself sane, he would read a lot in the prison library, and he happened to read a book about DNA profiling, which was perfected in 1984 by a professor in Leicester, England, and a light bulb went on, and Bloodsworth said, well, this could be used to prove I was not the killer. And it just happened that his attorney had asked that all the evidence in the case be saved, and it was sent to a lab in California and tested, and he was exonerated and set free after 9 years in prison. He was the first death row inmate to be set free by DNA testing in this country.
And then he went on and made it part of his cause.
He did. He was instrumental in getting the Innocence Protection Act and the testing portion of that act, which any convicted prisoner is tested for DNA now. Their DNA is recorded, and that test is named in Bloodsworth's honor.
Well, Paul Martin, thank you so much, and thank you for honoring the everyday Americans who shape our world. The book, again, is called Secret Heroes. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Maria.
Stay tuned. This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. Who were the tens of thousands of people who remained loyal to Britain during the American Revolutionary War, and what happened to them? Among the one quarter of all American colonists who decided to stay loyal to the king in 1776, there were at least 20,000 slaves and free people of African descent. Where did they go after the war? And what do their stories tell us about American history? We're joined by Harvard history professor Maya Jasanoff, and we're talking about her latest book, Liberty's Exiles, American Loyalists in the Revolutionary War. Welcome, Maya Jasanoff.
Great to speak with you.
It's great to have you. So you have been looking at this aspect of American and British history that hasn't been looked at really very closely, and that is that there was a very large, what we call loyalist community, that is people that were loyal to the British crown, during the American Revolution. And it wasn't really a small number. Tell us about this community.
A lot of Americans don't realize that our revolution was really a civil war. It was our first civil war. And it was a war that divided people up and down the colonies as they were then around the question of whether to be independent. And so for the average American at the beginning of the American Revolution, the default position was actually to stay loyal to Britain. And up to maybe a third of Americans are believed to have being loyal to Britain throughout the war, not necessarily gone along with the patriot vision of independence and freedom and so on that we think of as having been so widespread in retrospect. But for them, really, staying with the status quo, staying with Britain was something that was very powerful and important to them.
That brings up a few questions. One is really the role of people like Thomas Paine, who allegedly was this person who reframed the entire idea of independence and revolution in a way that made it seem honorable rather than treasonous. So apparently it didn't work with all people. Why do you think that is?
I think that Thomas Paine, who was himself British, did do something amazing for Americans, as did Thomas Jefferson in the opening of the Declaration of Independence. And I think that they put a language to the cause of independence that had not been there before and that really gave American patriots a rhetorical advantage over Britain in the Revolution. That said, rhetoric is not the same as daily life, and it doesn't put food on your table, and it doesn't look after your family, and it doesn't govern the kinds of relationships that you have in your home, in your business, and all the rest of it. And so I think for many people living in the colonies at that time, while this rhetoric was very, very seductive and obviously went on to have a great resonance in and beyond our nation, there was still a powerful sense of the ways in which they wanted to have lives for themselves that could have profit and could have political coherence and could protect them from threats around the world. And those were all goals that many Americans continued to see held out for them in the crown of Britain and remaining part of the British Empire.
You noted that a lot of the people were members of the Anglican Church. Many of them were connected to the imperialists. But there were other kinds of loyalists there as well. It seemed like there was a diversity of them, including the people of African descent, something like you said, 20,000 slaves, and also free people of African descent. Talk about the various kinds of loyalists, so-called loyalists, and
sure,
their various reasons.
We in America usually think of loyalists as having belonged to a very small elite, as having been predominantly white men in positions of power, Anglican, strong ties to Britain, wealthy for the most part. This was, in fact, only a subset of who loyalists were, just as it was only a subset of who Americans were. And one of the things that is really important to know about loyalism at this time is that it cut right across the spectrum of early America. It cut across the ethnic spectrum, the geographical spectrum, the religious spectrum, and the spectrum of occupations and all the rest of it. So people had their own reasons for staying loyal that could come out of belief, pragmatic calculation, and also opportunities. And this is where the story of group of African Americans called the Black Loyalists is particularly fascinating and important, I think, for us to look at. We know that in the United States there was this wonderful language of freedom, independence, liberty, that celebrated by Paine and Jefferson and more, but it didn't extend, of course, to the 500,000 slaves who were held in the U.S. at that time. Instead, many of them saw liberty offered to them by the British Empire. And early in the war, just a few months after the American Revolution began, British commanders began issuing promises to patriot-owned slaves in Virginia and elsewhere, telling them that if they came and joined the British, then they would get freedom in exchange for doing that. And so for them, the promise of liberty was really held out by Britain and the Empire, and about 20,000 black slaves ended up joining the British, and a good half of them survived the war and ended up being evacuated in freedom at the war's end to live out liberty in the British world.
And there were also several thousand of the free people of African descent as well.
Yes, and in particular, these slaves who became free as a result of British promises. And British commanders really, in quite an admirable gesture that I think has been neglected by historians, really stuck up for the freedom of these people in the face of great American opposition. And in fact, George Washington himself confronted the British commander at the end of the war, saying, "You guys are taking away our property," as he saw the former slaves. And the British commander stood up and said, "Look, you know, these are free people, and I'm not going to take their freedom away from them." And George Washington was very put out by this. Not least, some of his own former slaves went off into the British Empire and had new lives. But the fact is that Washington's vision of freedom and liberty did not apply to and did not extend to these formerly enslaved people.
So given the extent of the people that were loyalists, you said it was one-third of the people settling in America. That's a huge number. So what accounts for, you've got the British Army, which was very strong. You've got one-third of the people living there siding with the British Army, and they still lost.
Yes, it is one of the great what-if questions in certainly British imperial history. There are really a couple of things that account for why loyalists didn't win the day. And I do think that that rhetorical advantage that the U.S. had was very powerful. And I also think, and this comes back to the issue of civil war, at the end of the day, British people living in Britain and colonists of British extraction living in the 13 colonies shared more than divided them. And when faced with this potentially protracted, bloody, divisive war, I think many people on both sides really had a kind of lack of will to keep fighting it out when they could find ways to redefine the relationship peacefully. So by the time the Americans had this kind of coherent sense of who they were going to be, the British were interested in trying to find a kind of common ground with what became the United States.
Now, here in the U.S., we are taught about the spirit of 76. You talk about the spirit of 1783. Tell us about that.
So one of the great paradoxes about the American Revolution is that Britain lost this war. It was the biggest loss of territory for the British Empire until the era of World War II, until the whole empire fell apart in the 20th century. And yet, it was Britain, not the United States, that went on to be the big world power throughout the 19th century, up until, in fact, about World War II. So how could it be that Britain lost these colonies, these closest possessions, very valuable culturally and politically, nevertheless go on to kind of new heights? And the answer, I suggest, is that they took away lessons from losing in America. And those lessons, I think, were summed up in what I call the spirit of 1783. And they included a new sense, really, of how to manage relations between the government and the people, and to manage them in ways that meant that people of all kinds of religions and ethnicities living all around the world could find a place within the hierarchy of the empire. They would have liberty up to a point. They would be held in check by institutions of the crown and its officers. And in this kind of balance, you saw a form of government that actually proved remarkably resilient and successful. around the world. And it was the experience of having lost the colonies where this kind of balance didn't work out for Britain that helped them figure out where to go next and come up with what turned out to be a very successful formula moving forward into the 19th and 20th centuries.
It worked for a little while.
150-odd years is not so bad as a run of things at the top of the world.
And so I understand that this loyalism versus patriotism really did break up families, communities, other relations. How prevalent was this kind of division that occurred?
I think it was a lot more prevalent than we generally think, again. And the best example of this kind of division can be found in one of our founding fathers, Benjamin Franklin, whose own son, William Franklin, ended up being a very powerful leading loyalist, as important to the loyalist community as Benjamin Franklin was to the patriot community. And here was a rift between father and son created by the war. And so while Benjamin Franklin was managing American affairs diplomatically through the war and ultimately negotiated the peace settlement that defined U.S. independence, William Franklin was arrested by the Patriots, jailed for some time, spent time in British-occupied New York City organizing Loyalist resistance to Patriot forces, and ended up spending the end of the war himself in exile in Britain and ending up on the losing side. But the passions that were ignited by this war were, I think, very strong, and the principles people had in the case of the Franklins, you know, could be very powerful, and it really could divide even this very close father and son. We tend to think of ourselves as having always been a very united people, but to remember the ways in which we weren't always united is very important for us as we live through an era of seeming partisanship in our country today.
The big question that arose for me is how this history impacts our understanding of historic America and the founding of America. What would you say the impact is?
There are two aspects to this that I really believe are important. One is that America really was based on wonderful principles and promises and rhetoric, and yet we have never been a monolithic society. We have always been a society with many, many voices, very plural, very multi-ethnic. I believe that that's very much a source of our strength, but it's also, of course, been a source of tension historically right the way through our national history, the Civil War being a great example. So the importance of remembering that even at the outset we had all kinds of divisions might make it easier for us somehow to accept that we're going to continue to be divided, and that's part of what makes us who we are. We share some values, we're going to debate them, and we're going to fight about them, and that's part of what we're about. The second point is also very important for America right now, and that is that we have long really been proud of what makes our national history so special and so distinctive. But our national history has always been in a larger international context. And you know, one of the things about the Loyalist refugees is that American influences through these people ended up spreading out across the world. And it's just a really important reminder that our history has always been bound up with the histories of other nations.
Maya Jazanoff, thank you so much for being with us. The name of the book is Liberty's Exiles, American Loyalists in the Revolutionary World.
Great to talk with you.
When we come back, Anthony Kennedy's retirement opens big constitutional and political questions for the future of the United States. Stay tuned. You are listening to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. Great speculation has arisen about the effects of Justice Anthony Kennedy's resignation, particularly on the rights, liberties, and politics in the United States. Will it ultimately change course in the USA? And does this also illuminate the fundamental flaws in the U.S. politics, in the Supreme Court system itself, and on the Constitution? We continue our conversation with our experts. Stephen Griffin is a professor of constitutional law at Tulane University. He's the author of American Constitutionalism, From Theory to Politics, Long Wars and the Constitution and Broken Trust, Dysfunctional Government and Constitutional Reform. Sanford Levinson is a professor in the Department of Government at the University of Texas. He is the author of The Undemocratic Constitution and Nullification and Secession in Modern Constitutional Thought, and Framed, America's 51 Constitutions and the Crisis of Governance. John Weil is a dean and a professor of political science at the Middle Tennessee State University. He is the author of Constitutional Law in Contemporary America, Essential Supreme Court Decisions, and The Writing and Ratification of the U.S. Constitution. This was part two of a two-part series. You can listen to the first parts at scholarcircle.org. Welcome to the three of you. It's great to have you back here on the Scholar Circle. The issue that I was trying to raise in terms of the integrity of democracy and the integrity of elections as well, I guess was partly also in what I've been seeing coming down in the decisions over the last few terms around the issues of electoral integrity and around the issues of labor unions or whatever the issues are. If they seem to be harming the Republican Party's power base, they seem to be finding the legal reasoning to justify eliminating one more aspect of possibility of Republicans losing power. And that might be a really naive way to look at it. But when I step back, and of course I live in another country now, so I can look at it from far away and go, you know, this looks a little fishy to me. Am I out of my mind? Stephen Griffin?
I don't think so. I was kicking myself for not mentioning voting rights. I think if you come at things from a Democratic or liberal perspective, the prospects for voting rights are looking very grim. And this is a court that's already given a pass, also in a decision that's, you know, on voter IDs, it's widely seen as a mistake, but even by the justices who decided it. But still, there's a lot of ferment that's been going on in the lower courts, with lower courts finding evidence that I consider pretty strong evidence of discriminatory intent. But the Supreme Court's already been a block, and it's only going to get worse. And so there's going to have to be, regardless of your political orientation, it's pretty obvious, it's going to have to be a lot of rethinking on the Democratic side of how they approach the court in the future. And another thing this appointment could be setting up, far beyond the Trump administration, is a massive clash in the future between the next Democratic president and a court that could turn out to be not just conservative, but very hardline conservative in the pursuit of a very rigid and formal vision of the rule of law.
John Weil?
If I can say one thing about the voting rights, probably among the most consequential cases of this term were the cases dealing with gerrymandering. I think that the problems of gerrymandering are much more difficult for judges to resolve in a way that doesn't, you know, sort of start you back from scratch and often comes a little bit late to be able to do it in time for an election than some of the other problems. So I guess I'm not as down on the court for some of those decisions as maybe some of the others.
Yeah, if I can jump in for a second, my view is that liberals especially put way, way too much stock in the ability of the Supreme Court to alleviate what I regard as a truly dreadful system of representative government in the United States. From my perspective, the basic problem is single-member districts and first-past-the-post voting. I think you live in New Zealand now, is that right?
That's right.
Yeah. New Zealand and Germany, I think, have the best formal electoral systems in the world because they figured out a way to combine geographical districting with national parties and thus prevent the kind of grotesque distortions that we have in both the House and the Senate. They're quite different distortions, obviously. So what I would like to see is a national movement that would begin by repealing an 1842 Act of Congress that requires single-member districts and really talk about what a democratic system of representation would look. The Supreme Court, for a variety of reasons, has said almost nothing of genuine theoretical interest in the almost 60 years that it has been in the redistricting business. Its decisions are mush. So I had very mixed feelings when the Supreme Court punted a couple of weeks ago. I tend to view it as a Republican court deciding to help out the Republican Party, but I also think that John is absolutely correct. It's an incredibly difficult problem, and in some ways, the last thing in the world I would want is for the general population to believe that the Supreme Court was on the case so we could relax.
That's a good point. Now, I think we are pretty far away from that. It seems to me, from what I've been reading, that the general public, the American electorate, has really lost faith in government, and that would include the court, save the extreme members of the Republican Party. So I think this is potentially a different kind of crisis, maybe the opposite crisis.
There's certainly a lot of loss of faith in the media, which, whether Trump is the cause or he's just a reflection, but I think we no longer seem to agree even on what the facts are. Sandy pointed earlier to the polarization. It's almost as though we're living in two different political worlds.
I can definitely see that. I mean, that's my area of expertise, right? Media primarily. And you definitely see oppositional framing and very simplistic frames, particularly on the right side. But I also think you have a huge loss in faith in the government, from what I've been reading. On the right side, there's a propagation of a narrative about this deep state as well.
This is something I've written about, the problem of trust. It is a problem. Now, historically, the Supreme Court has been one of the more or the most trusted branch of government. There's evidence that suggests that's partly because the American public did not perceive it as being involved in day-to-day partisan politics, being very aware, the court is not elected, and there's a part of the public that views that as a good thing, not a bad thing. I do think that current Chief Justice is actually quite worried about preserving the long-term institutional integrity of the court. Doesn't mean he's not a conservative. He's very conservative. But it also means that to the extent he becomes, as many people are saying, the new swing vote on the court, it may cause him to start slicing the salami as thin as Anthony Kennedy did in the right cases. That could be a little bit of a break. I wouldn't say moving the court to the center. That is like an overdone metaphor. But it's another variable, you see, that could suddenly spring to the fore and surprise people, because some people like to say every justice makes a new court. In other words, every justice forces everybody on the court to reconsider their own positions. And that's going to be especially true of the Chief Justice. His role is on the line here just as much as the content of the views of the new justice will affect the court.
Let me ask another provocative question. Sandy Levinson, this may be something that, being the contrarian that you are, I say lovingly, is the Supreme Court, with only 9 justices, making these gargantuan decisions that affect the lives of millions of people, is this system outdated?
I really don't like the U.S. Constitution, and I think that we are living with the consequences of a Constitution that was defective in 1787, and from my perspective, is taking over a cliff right now. With regard to the court itself, I frankly don't know what an ideal number would be. My own view is that if the Democrats win in 2020, and if the Democrats recapture the Senate in 2020, then one of the first proposals will be to increase the number of justices on the court. in order to recapture control of what Democrats regard as a near pooch with regard to the stolen seat of Merrick Garland, and now the rapid confirmation of whoever Trump names. And who knows, by 2020, I mean, Ruth Ginsburg, who I think should have resigned in 2013, can't live forever. So who knows what the reality will be in 2020. FDR obviously shot himself in the foot with his court packing plan. I don't know that that would be so fatal to a Democratic president and a Democratic Senate in 2020. Now, all hell would break loose, but it would simply be another sign of the remarkable polarization of American politics.
If I could mention something here, you know, there's a surprising number
of... Is this Stephen Griffin?
Steve Griffin. There's a surprising number of legal academics of both parties who for some time now have favored what other countries have done with their high court, which is limited terms, long terms,
yep,
but limited terms rather than life tenure, and mandatory retirement. And to me, that would be a more productive way to spend some time and possible reform than just increasing the size of the court, which is going to look incredibly partisan. But there's a good argument that, like John Vile says, yes, Trump has been very lucky, but not all presidents are, and particularly President Clinton and Bush. We went for nearly 8 years, 9 years, without a single appointment. I don't think that was good for either of those presidents or for the court.
John Vile?
I'm a little bit more in favor of the Constitution as it is than Sandy is. But, you know, some of his points are certainly well taken. I do think if you look across the world, you know, most countries that have been able to preserve constitutionalism and preserve rights have had a fairly strong system of judicial review. I think one of the most interesting things that I've heard Trump say in regard to Kennedy's replacement is that he's hoping for somebody who's going to be on the court for 40 years. The Constitution does provide an incentive which might be somewhat perverse in that you want somebody who's going to be there as long as you can, so if we're not careful, we're going to be appointing people right out of law school. But we should remember that no one has yet made the 40-year mark. Kennedy, I believe, was 32, and I believe that Douglas made it to 36 or 37.
Yeah.
Sandy will probably know better than I do, but my knowledge, no one has yet made it to 40 years.
18 years, non-renewable, is probably literally more than enough. I think life tenure is crazy. If you look at the American states, only either one or two of the 50 states have life tenure. If you look around the world, very, very few countries have life tenure. My view of the Constitution is that it actually doesn't require life tenure, but I think that most law professors disagree because I think they wrongly read during good behavior as a guarantee of life tenure rather than simply saying you can't be impeached for writing decisions that Congress doesn't like.
But I hope we're not going to make old age lack of good behavior. Some of us are going to be in trouble for our life.
Right. But, you know, I agree that it would be an easier conversation to have to ask about life tenure, but the problem is that even if one got a statute or a constitutional amendment getting rid of life tenure, it's not going to be retroactive.
Right.
So you're not going to get rid of a 42-year-old that Donald Trump might appoint. Clarence Thomas was 42 years old when he was appointed. He celebrated his 70th birthday last week, I think, but he could easily make it to 40 years. I think that no sane constitutional designer in the 21st century would emulate the U.S. Constitution, and the best proof of that is simply looking at constitutions that have been designed both in the United States and around the world.
I want to shift direction just a little bit once more and put a little historic context into what we're going to be dealing with in terms of the decisions coming down. And this is partly a result of, I've been thinking about historically, if you look at the court decisions and what courts had been doing before the civil rights movement, you know, it had primarily been elite people and corporate decisions. And then you had this sort of shift, which people call the rights revolution. And the courts seem to increasingly be ruling for individual rights, civil rights, women's rights, rights of the accused. Part of that explanation is, well, you had diversity of lawyers pushing this agenda, but there was also an infrastructure that the government was supporting that would enable them to do this kind of a work. Is all that getting dismantled, and are we going to end up going back to the old days? John Weil.
It's common at political science and probably at law professor meetings, too, to sometime in the conversation to remind people that we have a whole system of courts at both 50 different state systems as well as the federal system. And in the federal system, you have three different tiers. And, you know, there is a phenomenon, to take the most obvious, since there's been so much discussion as to whether, you know, a new justice will overturn abortion, or more than likely, I would say, make it more restrictive rather than probably directly overturn Roe versus Wade. But, you know, even if that happens, we would still have probably a mosaic of state laws. It would undoubtedly affect poor women more strongly than it would women who would be able to move. But, I think you would have many states who would, you know, continue to have fairly liberal laws regarding abortion. So sometimes we focus a little bit too much on the top and, you know, just forget that, you know, we have a lot of people that have been educated in the law and that are practicing in the law and that believe very strongly in rights. And I don't think the system is quite ready to be flushed down the toilet, though there's obviously some cause for concern.
Steve Griffin?
There's no going back in a literal sense to where America was before the rights revolution. But to me, it's more an issue of, are there analogous problems, you know, of segregation today that the court isn't dealing with? And I don't think there's any doubt that there is. One of the big issues that people inside the legal system know about, but is rarely discussed outside it, is the court's been in a deep freeze and unwilling to apply the basic guarantee of equal protection to the criminal justice system and the actions of the police. And this deep freeze, this lack of any recourse, I think is part of the problem that's led to a very dysfunctional situation between the police and the minority community, because the police haven't had any incentive from the courts to get better. The incentive has been coming here and there occasionally from administrations that put the Civil Rights Division, and sometimes the cities like New Orleans ask for help. But this criminal justice situation, which everyone acknowledges is a problem, is it something that can be dealt with? The courts have been on the sidelines, and that's the result of decades of, I'm afraid, conservative reluctance to get involved in issues like this. And I'm afraid that particular side of things is only going to get worse. And just keep in mind, when I was talking about voting rights, I wasn't even referring to the partisan gerrymandering case, which is the new issue. I was referring to the old issues of, can you vote at all in terms of voter ID requirements and discriminatory use of voting regulations against minority populations. Those are, in theory, already addressed by existing laws, but it matters whether the court is behind those laws and will enforce them. If it doesn't, you're going to get a much more volatile situation produced in minority communities, regardless of what you think of the particular problem of partisan gerrymandering.
I'd like to pick up on one point with regard to your question. If you look at Brown versus Board of Education, for example, which has, you know, become the sacred myth and symbol for people who really like the Supreme Court, it's very, very important to realize that both the Truman and Eisenhower administrations were pushing for desegregation, that the court in no sense was defying the executive branch. It was going after segregated states with the very, very strong approval of the executive branch. And if one is going to be candid, you have to realize that even Richard Nixon ended up being much more supportive than in opposition to the courts in the late 60s and early 70s with regard to desegregation, not with regard to busing, but with regard to, you know, the importance of desegregation. Nixon was not himself terrible. His attorney generals were not terrible. Jeff Sessions is terrible. The United States Department of Justice is terrible. That is the Trumpification. So what we have now is a national government. I don't want to say for the first time, because during the Reagan administration, there were certainly some people who wanted, you know, to clip particularly affirmative action and the like. But you have, I think, a much, much more hardline, basically white supremacist attorney general. It's so ironic that Jeff Sessions has become a hero of sorts because Donald Trump detests him because of the Mueller stuff. But I think that the civil rights movement depended, among other things, on a genuine mass movement that had political allies and institutional allies within the executive branch and Congress.
Which we don't have now. We just don't really have much of that now, right?
No.
Yep.
There is no significant mass movement in American politics right now remotely comparable to the civil rights movement. Congress is awful in a way that the Congresses of the 50s, 60s, and 70s were not. And those really have to be discussed as part of this whole mosaic, as it were. And the courts are only one part. You know, they're an important part, but they're only one part of the overall American political system.
So, Sandy, you said one name in that paragraph that I want to bring up now, because I think it might make a difference who is in the Supreme Court with that one name that you mentioned, and that is Mueller. So in our last few minutes that we've got...
I don't think Trump's going to appoint him. I'm sorry.
I think my question is more akin to what we opened the conversation about, which is presidential power and pardoning power and all of that type of a thing with this looming report that's coming from Mr. Mueller. John Vile, do you want to start with this?
We can't read the future, obviously, but it's possible that Trump is at the very top of his popularity and that it won't last forever. He certainly made, I think, some very obvious mistakes in the treatment of immigrants in a way that, you know, I think touched heartstrings of people who might not otherwise have been able to do it. I don't think it's by any means clear that his policy in regard to North Korea or to tariffs or to taxation or any number of his policies are necessarily going to work. And, you know, what we may be seeing now might be a very different configuration even by the elections in this November or certainly in 2020. So, you know, my hope is that our institutions are a little bit more resilient than they seem. But I must say that particularly when you look at Congress, the only people who seem to have backbone seem to be the people who are retiring and are not worrying about reelection. But again, so much of that is dependent on, you know, the belief that everybody's behind Trump and that he's sort of a juggernaut that you simply can't oppose.
I think part of the drive to get the nominee, who I gather is going to be announced on July 9th, confirmed by Labor Day, is to avoid the Mueller report, so that whatever it is, Donald Trump's nominee will be on the court. I have never thought the Republicans were stupid. I think a number of them are evil, but I don't think they're stupid. And I think that they realize that they're in a race against the clock. Nobody knows about Mueller. Nobody knows exactly what the Senate will look like in January. So the rational thing to do is to exercise as much power as possible while they've got it.
Final words, Stephen Griffith?
I think that's true. They do seem in an awful hurry. I myself don't think that the Mueller report will make a difference one way or the other. In theory, it could tee up an impeachment effort, but not when Republicans control the House. Obviously, it could tee up an impeachment effort in the future when Democrats, perhaps, control the House. But I'm very skeptical of the idea, which is obviously afoot among some Democrats, that the impeachment process is going to solve all their problems. I don't think that's a good way to think about our constitutional system. It's not a good way to think about Trump either, I don't think.
John Vile, final words?
I think I agree with both my colleagues here. Again, I don't think that where Trump is now is necessarily where he's going to be in November or 2 years from now.
And Sandy, last thoughts.
I want to underscore one thing that John said. State courts can turn out to be extraordinarily important in a number of these issues. So that if you're talking about abortion, for example, the real question is whether the Republicans will have the power after the midterms to pass a national act criminalizing abortion. And if they do, then that would preempt states, presumably. Otherwise, I think the most likely thing to end up with is frankly what we have right now, which is a patchwork quilt where there are some states where abortions really are relatively easily available and others where they've simply been shut down. But I also agree with Steve that the Mueller report may turn out to be far more bark than bite.
Well, gentlemen, I thank you for joining us again here on the Scholar Circle. Sandy Levinson, John Vile, and Steve Griffin. Great pleasure hosting you. Thank you so much for your time and your wisdom.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Stephen Griffin is a professor of constitutional law at Tulane University. He's the author of American Constitutionalism, From Theory to Politics, Long Wars and the Constitution and Broken Trust, Dysfunctional Government and Constitutional Reform. Sanford Levinson is a professor in the Department of Government at the University of Texas. He is the author of The Undemocratic Constitution and Nullification and Secession in Modern Constitutional Thought and Framed, America's 51 Constitutions and the Crisis of Governance. John Vile is a dean and a professor of political science at the Middle Tennessee State University. He is the author of Constitutional Law in Contemporary America, Essential Supreme Court Decisions, and The Writing and Ratification of the U.S. Constitution. And that's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to those who make this program possible. To Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Ankine Arasyan, Melissa Chiprin, Anais Amin, Mike Hurst, and Tim Page, most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can check out our archives at scholarcircle.org, kpfk.org, and please like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at Armudian, and we'll see you next week.